This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
And with that, it is midnight in New York City, and you've been listening to a rebroadcast of the evening news on listener-supported, non-commercial, WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming on the web at WBAI.org. And that means that if all goes according to plan, what's coming up toot sweet is this. Moorish, Orthodox, Radio, Crusade, Anarchism for the Global City, Radical Environmentalism for the Concrete Jungle, Esoteric Explorations of the Secret History of Rebel Culture, the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. Every Tuesday at midnight after the news, only on listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Be there. Well, tonight, once again, we're going to be talking about food. Certainly one of my favorite subjects. Anybody out there feeling hungry?
2, 3, 4.
The day, standing on the corner to pass time away, with my hands in my pockets and my pockets in my pants, watching the kids do a double dutch dance. I realized I was hungry and I knew I didn't have too much money. One thing about hunger I would like to say, if you don't eat something, it won't go away. My stomach was so empty, he was starting to talk. I went to take him for a little walk. I strolled to the supermarket just to look in the windows. Wasn't much in my pocket. When I got there, the doors opened wide. What could I do? I went inside. The joint was humongous. The atmosphere cold. Everything in the world was being sold. I took a good look so I wouldn't get lost. Then I went to check what everything cost. I went up the aisle. Here's what I saw. 3 cucumbers, $1.24. 1 avocado, $1.63. You're supposed to grab them off the tree. 3 little tomatoes, $1.08. With a scale you can't see, so they teach you on the way. $1.20 for a whole wheat bread. I might as well smoke pot instead. I went to the back to look at the meat. There was nothing I could afford to eat. $12.75 for a roast of pork. A quarter of a bite when the pork is on a fork. A 4-pound chicken, $3.92. That's $4 more for Frank Perdue. I had looked at the meat. I was through when the butcher said, "May I help you?" I said, "I'm vegetarian. Meat is queer." He said, "What the hell are you doing here?" I backed off and went around the rest of the store. Would you believe what I saw? They had a big soda for $1.25. But that's what you pay for bubbles in the water. 99 cents a quart of orange juice. I tried to change the tag. It wouldn't come loose. Say, gallon of milk, $1.99. I might as well drink a gallon of wine. The TV dinner looked real good. So many ingredients, I wouldn't eat it if I could. It had monosodium glutamate, calcium propionate, diethyl methyl benzoate. I would hate to see that stuff on my plate. The box showed a blonde and a silly dude. It disguised the fact it was plastic food. They had a box of potatoes made from powder, a pack of tin foil they call clam chowder, crunchy chemicals called frosted flakes, candy painted purple to look like grapes, Cherry soda that had no cherries. Strawberry jam with no strawberries. Apples that had been painted red. String beans in cans that were 2 years dead. Powdered soup, $1.03. 35 cents a can of iced tea. Mellow yellow, 2 for 86. Hey, I was in a hell of a fix. When you're broke, Twinkies never fail. They're all chemical, they never go stale. They cost you 45 cents. If that's all you eat, you can still pay rent. And you know for sure, without a doubt, they'll make every one of your teeth fall out. I was feeling low, I couldn't feel high, cause the Twinkies were all I could afford to buy. I thought people would scream, but they lost their voice. I did what I had to, I had no choice. I stuffed some spinach up under my shirt. I felt like Popeye, I couldn't get hurt. The lamb chops were greasy and full of fat. I boosted two up under my hat. I sniffed the salami as sly as a fox. I eased a few slices in my socks. The fancy cheese was $4.92. I tipped the package in my shoe. You know I wouldn't tell you a lie. I threw some apples in my fly. A banana down in my underpants. It looked so macho, I started to dance. I danced all around, took a good look. The coast was clear, I was ready to book. I started to walk out slow and bold. I was pushing and dripping like I had a cold. I thought everybody was looking at me. My pants were leaking like I was three. I took the Twinkies to have one thing to buy. The grease from the lamb running in my eye. I went to the checkout to pay my money. The lady looked at me kind of funny. My knees got up tight, they started to knock. She said, I know you from around the block. You used to mess with my little cousin. Will you get some eggs? Give me a dozen. Then she said real loud, 45 cents. If you keep eating Twinkies, your mind will get bent. I was through the door and into the street. The cheese melting all in my feet. I had ripped off everything but the kitchen sink. More than that, I started to think. The farmer grows the food, he can't afford to eat it. The farm worker picks it, he can't afford to eat it. The packer packs it, he can't afford to eat it. The driver drives it, he can't afford to eat it. The clerk tags it, she can't afford to eat it. The checkout bags it, she can't afford to eat it. Seems the more we work, the more we get beat. And now people can't even afford to eat. I was thinking about the reason why. When my sister came walking by, I gave her a little treat. Then my friend Willie came down the street. Right away, I gave him some food. I knew that would make his family feel good. Then I saw Grandma with a milk box chair. I gave her everything then and there. She said, thank you, honey, get a box, sit down. Free food's the sweetest, pound for pound. I want to tell you about what's coming around. There's one place where real food can be found. This whole thing's about a piece of ground. The whole thing's about a piece of ground. Everything of value comes from two places now. From this earth and from the sweat of your brow. Today, this earth is owned by the big corporation. They just about own the whole nation. The land is cement, you can't feel the grass. You wouldn't know fresh food if it bit your. The most land you get is a parking space. You got to go to the store to feed your face. Without the land, we cannot eat. The corporation always has us beat. Grandma stopped rapping, she had wrapped it up. I brought her water from the pump in a cup. And we both had a drink, then I felt good. I fed lots of people in the neighborhood. The Twinkies were all I had left that day. I gave everything else away. Now I don't want money to make me a punk. If I can get food, why eat junk? I threw the Twinkies in the sewer. I don't poison my friends, but I wished I had my 45 cents. Then I tightened my pants, gave my belt a pull. Something funny happened you don't learn in school, cause I had fed everybody else. My own stomach felt full. I just knew they were upstairs eating my food. They gave me nourishment, encouragement. I felt good. I thought later someone might give me a feast. When we share together, you feel like a man and not a beast.
I need not search for precious gold. Of wealth I have my share. For with my eyes I scan the skies and find my fortune there. A host of priceless dreams unfold in songs that bluebirds sing. The earth, the sea, belong to me. I'm richer than a king. To add to things that money cannot buy, an echo brings this very soft reply.
Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today. We string beans and onions, cabbages and scallions, and all kinds of fruit and say. We have an old-fashioned tomato, Long Island potato. But yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Yes, we know you gotta die of bananas. We know you gotta die of banana today. But 1 minute, we got a new kind of the garlic. When you use this garlic, to make you stand apart from your friends. We got a 64,000 watermelon. We don't sell any, but the guy we buy them from, Mamma Mia, does he sell a watermelon? But yes, we know you gotta die of bananas. Hey, why you? We know you gotta die of bananas today.
Yes, we have no bananas. What's that in off a banana? Now, what good is a banana split? Oh, we have muttons and buttons and kippers with zippers and pounds of devaluated pounds. Banana, S-T-I-N-K.
They ain't no stinking bananas.
Precisely, they ain't no stinking bananas. Yes, we have no bananas. Pip, pip, cheerio, and all the treats.
We got pickles and cracks, we got bagels and lox. A bagel that's a doner dipped in cement. We got delicious knishes and kosher champagne. The kosher champagne is 2 cents plain. Pastrami, salami, matzos, and jam. You should find an expression. We even got ham, but yes, we ain't got bananas. We ain't got bananas today.
All right, taking the Wayback Machine, opening up on the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade with two songs about food. And both of them are quite obviously dated, because in that first one, of course, that was New York's own Professor Louie singing a song entitled, quite appropriately, Food. And his relating the adventure that he has at the supermarket, adventures in shoplifting with Professor Louie. he lists all of the prices for, you know, all these exorbitant prices for all the stuff that he feels obliged to rip off at the supermarket. And of course, by today's standards, it's all cheap. So obviously that song was recorded 20 years ago or more, back in the 1980s. And before that, of course, that was Spike Jones with his classic, Yes, We Have No Bananas, going way back to, oh my God, the 40s, maybe earlier. I was trying to find the date for that song on the internet, and I couldn't find it. But a long time ago, and of course, you know, you could never get away with all of the cliched ethnic stereotype raps at the at the end in that song. You'd never get away with that today. So obviously we're taking the Wayback Machine tonight, but two classics, I say. Food by Professor Louie and Yes, We Have No Bananas by Spike Jones. And you know, Professor Louie's rap at the end of that song that his grandmother gives him sitting on milk crates on the sidewalk there, about how it all comes down to who controls the land, you know? He sort of anticipated the whole concept of food sovereignty, which has really sort of exploded as a concept in the generation since Professor Louie wrote that song. Professor Louie is still at it, by the way. I was looking for him on the web earlier, and I found his MySpace page. So I haven't heard from him in a long time, but he's still out there, and he's still performing. So big ups to you, Professor, if you're listening tonight. And
especially for anticipating the whole notion of food sovereignty, which is particularly relevant to what's in the headlines right now. I mean, the whole peak oil crisis, so-called, which is greatly misunderstood, in fact, I mean, we could talk about that later, but the whole peak oil crisis is sort of metamorphosed into a peak food crisis, as we know, of course, the diversion of croplands into production of so-called biofuels or agrofuels, as they're variously known, has caused food prices to shoot up and resulting in, I mean, just food riots going on all over the world now. Have you been following this, guys? I mean, Haiti was the most recent example to explode, but there's been food riots in El Salvador, Egypt, Burkina Faso, Bangladesh, all over the place. There's been food riots over the course of the last month. So, you know, things are looking kind of grim out there. They really are, you know. Kind of reminds me of the Marvin Gaye line, God knows where we're headed, you know. So, let's see. Ostensibly, Anne-Marie Hendrickson was going to show up tonight to rap with me about vegetarianism. Both of us read a rather hefty volume called The Bloodless Revolution, A Cultural History of Vegetarianism from 1600 to Modern Times by Tristram Stewart. So we've been waiting for this magical evening when both Anne-Marie Hendrickson and myself are going to be in the studio together to discuss this book, which we've been waiting to do for months now. But maybe MTA has delayed Anne-Marie, but I always have plenty to say on the subject of food, and maybe I'll even get around to talking about a little bit about Tristram Stewart's book, The Bloodless Revolution, tonight, if Anne-Marie fails to show up. But I'm going to have some other things to say until Anne-Marie does show up, and I brought plenty more food-themed, and particularly vegetable-themed songs to play. Well, two events to announce, by the way, which are coming up, both on the theme which we are discussing tonight. And one is that there's going to be a book party a week from tonight. Oh, wait a minute. This was tonight, wasn't it? Tuesday, April 15th. Oh, well, too late. It was tonight at the Brecht Forum. A release party for the book Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System by Raj Patel. Stuffed and Starved is a startling expose of the global food system and how activists are gaining ground against its corporate control. Well, are they? I'd certainly like to think so. Half the world is malnourished, the other half obese, both symptoms of the corporate food monopoly. To show how a few powerful distributors control the health of the entire world, Raj Patel conducts a global investigation traveling from the green deserts of Brazil and protester-packed streets of South Korea to bankrupt Ugandan coffee farms in the barren fields of India. What he uncovers is shocking: the real reasons for famine in Asia and Africa, an epidemic of farmer suicides, and the false choices and conveniences in supermarkets. Yet he also finds hope in international resistance movements working to create a more democratic, sustainable, and joyful food system. From seed to store to plate, Stuffed and Starved explains the steps to regain control of the global food economy, stop the exploitation of farmers and consumers, and rebalance global sustenance. Well, sounds good. Sorry we didn't announce this last week, but at least now we know that this book exists, and everybody should go out and get a copy of Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System by Raj Patel. And maybe we will have him here on these airwaves to talk about his book in the weeks to come. And by the green deserts of Brazil, I assume that he's talking precisely about the diversion of croplands to grow non-food crops. Initially, it was maybe 10 years ago, people started using this phrase to talk about tree plantations for timber and for biomass energy conversion. But increasingly, the big issue having far, far greater impacts on global food prices is so-called biofuels. And the opponents of biofuels refuse to call them biofuels because bio means life. And they believe that, in fact, this is the diversion of crops from food, which sustains life. So it's actually anti-life. So they don't call them biofuels. They call them agrofuels. And I'm very glad that Raj Patel talks about not only a more democratic and sustainable food system, but a joyful food system. Because in the programming that Anne-Marie did in my absence, and you know, this is kind of what I wanted to talk about with Anne-Marie tonight, so maybe if she shows up, I'll give this rap again, but I'm going to give it now. And maybe you're home listening tonight, Anne-Marie, and you can respond on a future show. Posing this whole notion of you know, rival approaches to diet among people who are actually concerned with what they eat, which is a growing segment of American society anyway, Anne-Marie sort of posed a vegetarian gastropuritanism against an Epicurean gastrohedonism. That, you know, on one hand, you've just got these vegetarian worry warts who are just kind of, you know, wringing their hands with a concern about what they're putting into their body and how they are defiling the sacred temple of the body. And they're just like living on these very austere diets of, you know, brown rice and miso. And on the other hand, you've got, you know, the foodies, the real food heads out there, the people who shop at Whole Foods, or as my friends that I stayed with out in Oakland like to call it, Whole Paycheck, in reference to their rather exorbitant prices. And, you know, they're just, you know, on a food trip. You know, everything's got to be a real Epicurean delight, and everything's got to be very exotic and I would say pretentious. And it sort of, you know, follows the whole, what's missing here is like, you know, good old traditional food, right? And actual, you know, legitimate cuisines, which are rooted in centuries and centuries of peasant fare. And peasants not only trying to survive, sometimes under very meager circumstances, not only trying to make it under sometimes very difficult circumstances, but trying to make it nice, right? And actually trying to sustain family life and an actual pleasure in the, you know, daily rituals of sustaining oneself. You know, that's really where, you know, all this highfalutin haut cuisine originates from. And you can see, you know, it's sort of corruption into a mere bourgeois indulgence in the trajectory of, you know, and I've spoken about this before, the trajectory of how, you know, restaurants have evolved or devolved, how restaurant culture has changed here in New York City. And, you know, what's sort of being squeezed out is the middle ground. And you've got, you know, at one end, you've just got more and more fast food joints where, you know, people are just, you know, shoveling garbage heedlessly into their bodies. And on the other hand, you've got all these, like, you know, nouveau cuisine bistros where everything is very daintily arranged on the plate and it's all, you know, stacked vertically on the plate, very delicately balanced and very artfully arranged with all sorts of, you know, raspberry sauces and arugula and whatever. But is it particularly good food? You know, I don't like to eat that kind of food. You know, there's actually a difference, I think, between legitimate, you know, high cuisine, so to speak, and this nouveau schlock. So, you know, I don't turn my nose up at good quality food. Quite to the contrary, you know, but. It's actually, you know, not only, you know, sort of like middle range, wholesome, family owned, you know, working class eateries, which are being squeezed out, but even unfortunately, you know, like real good old school haute cuisine type places are being squeezed out in favor of like, you know, newfangled, you know, nouveau cuisine type places. where the portions are smaller and the prices are higher and everything is about novelty and not even particularly about, you know, how it tastes, I would argue, much less nutrition. So anyway, you know, I mean, I would argue that that maybe, you know, the whole, you know, juxtaposing of vegetarian gastro-puritanism and Epicurean gastro-hedonism is a false dilemma, and that it's possible to be a vegetarian epicure and to eat healthy food that really, really tastes good and that you savor with gusto. And you aren't just, you know, merely eating to sustain yourself. So this actually brings us to the second event, which I wanted to announce. Which, you know, we've got this one, rather than announcing it too late, I'm actually announcing it too early because it's still a month away. But since it's so theme appropriate to what we're going to be talking about tonight, I'm going to announce it anyway, which is that the first Veggie Pride Parade in America will take place in New York City on May 18th, 2008. So, yeah, we've got every other, this is for all the ethnic vegetarians out there, the people who identify first and foremost as vegetarians. This is, you know, their Pride Day, just like every other ethnic group out there has got a Pride Day. Well, now it's Vegetarian Pride Day. And the first Veggie Pride Parade in America will take place in Greenwich Village on May 18th, 2008. The procession will begin at 12 noon in, where else, the Old Meat District over on around Ganzevoort Square in the Far West Village, and will culminate in Washington Square Park, where a festival of rock music speakers and exhibitors will take place. So all of you veg heads out there, all of you people who feel oppressed and discriminated against as vegetarians, well, May 18th is going to be your big day, so mark your calendar now in green. And be at Ganzevoort Square in the former Meat District in the Far West Village at 12 noon or, I don't know, probably around 1 or 2. They'll be arriving in the eastern end of Washington Square Park. Washington Square Park, which, as we all know, is right now under brutal, vicious assault by New York University and the City Parks Department, which have sealed off the big center of the park to uproot a whole bunch of trees and to waste millions of dollars moving the fountain a couple of feet so that it perfectly aligns with Fifth Avenue and the Arch, which is really a bit of an atrocity, if you ask me. I mean, you know, when they originally designed the fountain, obviously they did that intentionally because they didn't want it to be perfectly symmetrical. And of all the things which we could be spending money on in this city and in this world, you know, moving the fountain, you know, spending $5 million, whatever it's going to be, to move the Washington Square Park fountain, you know, a couple of yards at the most to the east, strikes me as a boondoggle in the extreme, and probably just an excuse to, you know, remake Washington Square Park and keep it closed and keep it, you know, begin the semi-privatization of the park and make it, you know, even more into a just sort of a private NYU playground as opposed to an actual public commons. Which is also why I'm going to just say very briefly one of my big misgivings about the congestion pricing plan, why I actually sort of breathed a sigh of relief when congestion pricing was defeated, despite my deep, abiding, and visceral hatred of the automobile, is that, you know, it strikes me as it's the beginnings of the privatization of Manhattan. It's the beginnings of, you know, what's ultimately going to culminate in them building a big plastic dome over Manhattan Island and turning it into Manhattan land and charging people, you know, an entrance fee to enter it. And it's just going to be a playground for the rich and isn't going to actually be a community anymore. So certainly nobody is more sensitive to the problem of traffic congestion than I am. But I really question whether this is the solution. And, you know, this is part of the whole good ideas, such as, you know, banning cars or restricting car access to Manhattan and restoring pedestrian spaces and so on can very, very easily be co-opted in the interest of very, very bad and sinister agendas, in fact, of the privatization of public space and, essentially turning Manhattan into a mall. Which just goes to show that, there really isn't, nothing good can happen under capitalism. One way or another, you're screwed under capitalism. Doesn't matter whether it's war or it's peace or it's car proliferation or car exclusion. No matter what, as long as the capitalist system prevails, it's all garbage, right? And the only exception are when things actually do emerge from the grassroots up through struggle, grassroots struggle, popular struggle by the public. Where the E.P. Thompson called the moral economy of the system can actually be affected by clout of the populace organized of their own volition from below and actually can wrest concessions from the system, then maybe things can marginally improve under capitalism. But certainly this, congestion pricing plan was not an example of that. It was an elite solution, a technocratic solution, which came out of the political establishment and was only going to serve the interests ultimately of the political establishment. Well, let's see. You know what? Before we continue to talk about, vegetarianism, I should say that it is 12:30 in the morning on listener supported. Non-commercial, WBAI, 99.5 FM. This is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Bill Weinberg. We are waiting for the extremely elusive, not to say ephemeral, Anne-Marie Hendrickson, who perhaps will grace us with her presence tonight. But meanwhile, why don't we hear some more, why don't we hear a vegetable-themed song? Something else from the psychedelic era. Now, we all heard the last time we were beginning to talk about vegetarianism, another one of these, I think, abortive shows when Anne-Marie got lost on the subway. I played Ask Any Vegetable by Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. So there's a vegetable psychedelia, vegetable rock. You've heard of space rock and acid rock? Well, that's vegetable rock. So let's hear some more vegetable rock from the psychedelic era, shall we? And actually, this one is even more esoteric. So this is, let's see, this is only going to be the real aficionados who are going to be able to recognize this one.
About blue velvet trousers in my paisley shirt. I look a jerk, and my turquoise waistcoat is quite out of sight. But oh, oh, my haircut looks so bad. So I change my gear, and I find my knees, and I cover them up with the latest cut. Pants and zones, the forms in a box. It does take long to buy God old socks. The watch, black watch, my watch, with a black face and a date in a little hole. And all the luck is what I've got, it's what I wear, it's what you see, it must be me. Just ain't anywhere. Vegetable man. Vegetable man. Vegetable man.
right, that all you vegetable heads out there recognize that one. Of course, that was Vegetable Man. Vegetable Man, where are you? Sid Barrett. There's actually a story behind this song, which is that was supposed to have been on Pink Floyd's second album, Saucer Full of Secrets. And it wasn't, because in the middle of recording that album, Sid Barrett lost his marbles. He went insane and became impossible to work with and was purged from the group. And David Gilmour was brought in to replace him on lead guitar. The bassist, Roger Waters, of course, became the major songwriter in the group after that. They decided that Vegetable Man was just, it was too Sid Barrett. So they didn't record Vegetable Man, and it was only available on bootleg until very, very recently. And Anne-Marie Henriksen has just arrived. Hello, Anne-Marie.
Oh, keep going with what you're doing.
So did you know that song Vegetable Man by Sid Barrett? I'll bet you did.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And I'm very glad you played it, because you know what? I don't have it.
Oh, well.
So I'm glad that you did and that you played it.
And there you go. So, were you listening on the subway? Probably not.
Yes, but not closer to here, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, as you know, I sort of addressed some of the points that you brought up in the programming that you did in my absence, which I listened to on the internet out in California through the miracles of modern technology. And I was just remarking on that, on the show that you did about vegetarianism. Yes, you brought the same book that I did. The Bloodless Revolution by Tristram Stewart. Get it? The Bloodless Revolution? Haha.
This is an incredibly interesting book. Didn't you find it?
Yeah, it is. Really is an interesting book.
I mean, you know, as somebody who was a vegetarian, as I said, off and on for 25 years, I learned so much from this book that I didn't know. And I thought I knew a lot about it already. Wow.
That was released from Norton, was it last year, 2007, probably?
Yeah.
2006, actually, yeah. Well, the thing which surprised me about it is being of the generation that I am, of course, I think everything was invented in the 1960s. And I thought that there would be more in it about the stuff which actually did sort of lead up to and provide the groundwork for...
Your own vegetarianism.
My own vegetarianism, exactly.
But what you find out is that your own vegetarianism was led up to by centuries of vegetarianism of which you had no knowledge. That's the thing that I found really fascinating about this book. Because, and it's the whole, like,
you know, I thought there was going to be more, for instance, about the Theosophists and Annie Besant and so on, and they barely rate a mention.
Right, they're in at the end of the book, because what this guy is mostly interested in is that people became interested in vegetarianism through an interest in Indian religion that predated that by several centuries.
Well, or if you believe the theories about Pythagoras, by millennia.
Right, but I mean, but in a way, you know, if you believe that, he doesn't follow that.
Right.
You know, it's mostly stuff that happened within the last 700 or 800 years. And the influence that he's most interested in is a kind of, Orientalism, you know, and I personally, I would have thought that, yes, that within, you know, certainly within the last 60 or 70 years, that Orientalism played a great role in terms of the growth of vegetarianism in Europe and the United States. What I didn't realize until I read this book was that it played a really great role in vegetarianism in the centuries preceding that. That there was a tremendous interest in... the adoption of the vegetarian diet based on people wanting to for one thing, based on their desire to adhere to a non-European diet, but also that because vegetarianism had such a connection with heretical thought within Christianity, that it is his position that many people did not feel that they could publicly become vegetarians until they publicly positioned themselves outside of a Christian heretical framework, meaning that they felt that they could become vegetarians if they said that they were following a Brahmanistic framework. And that would not have occurred to me, because I would have felt that that would have been equally pagan within, European, social thought. But apparently this was not the case. As long as you were not connected with those, like, crazy numbnuts,
I'm sorry, who are the crazy numbnuts?
The European...
you mean the Cathars and
the
Albigensians and...
Yeah, the Cathars and the Albigensians and all... Yeah. Then, as long as you made it clear that you were not connected with those people, then, and that you had sort of gone to some foreign country and come up with this diet independent of, the Cathars and the Albigensians, that was a better route to go for a vegetarian diet than...
And yet there's also been this attempt to legitimize it through what are seen as more, legitimate aspects of the Western tradition, which is where the whole mythology of Pythagoras comes in.
And that comes in some ways comes in through the English Romantics, which he also talks about in the later part of the book through Shelley and, Ritson and people like that. And
Pythagoras had allegedly spent time among the so-called, the sages of India, the naked sages, is that what he calls
them? Right. And that's the tradition that I personally was more familiar with.
Right.
And my guess is that most people listening to the show and most people coming to this book are going to be more familiar with, because I believe that's the tradition that we are dealing with, where, for example, nudism and vegetarianism are going to be seen as part of the same tradition, whereas in an earlier tradition, they definitely are not. And that's what's really interesting about this book, because you think you know a lot about the history of vegetarianism, whether you are or you are not a vegetarian. And it turns out, maybe not. There's a lot more to the history of it, even in terms of Western adoption of vegetarianism, than is obvious if you're only looking at the Judeo-Christian tradition of adoption of vegetarianism and of heretical adoption of vegetarianism. There are many, many other people that come from other traditions that... take up this diet and write about it and have their friends, and as it turns out, have quite a large social influence, and they're not coming from that tradition. And that's where I found this book to be just fascinating, because it really filled in a lot of holes for me, because it's difficult otherwise to understand exactly why there were so many people in the 18th century, for example, that that were vegetarian. And when reading this book, it becomes clear that it was considered an extremely advanced way of looking at things. That in general, that looking at the scientific experience of India and China was considered an incredibly advanced way of looking at the world in general. And that the class prejudices of the 18th century also came into play, because the fact that the Brahmins of India were the vegetarian group of India made it more
enlightened and civilized.
And they were more enlightened, they were more civilized, and this made this more saleable to the ruling groups in Europe, but also in a weird way, it also made it more saleable to the working class
right.
of Europe and England, because it meant that they, you know, even though they might be many doors might be closed to them in Europe, certainly they could change their diet on their own, and then they would, you know, they would be, you know, walking right into the same advanced sort of nutritional practice that was practiced by people in India and in the East.
And also the association of vegetarianism with Puritanism played into actual revolutionary tendencies among the working class. It writes, you know, they're going back to the English Civil War and the levelers and the diggers and the shakers.
Right. And it becomes more, but it becomes more pronounced. It becomes more pronounced in the 18th and early 19th
right.
century.
Right.
And that, in fact, at that point, it becomes pronounced in a way that I think it's more familiar to us. I believe that we feel that vegetarianism is more connected with a left-leaning political view. And it isn't always, but in a way, the point I believe that the point at which it becomes more connected with a left political position is the late 18th century, and that's one of the most interesting parts of the book. The point at which Shelley and Byron and Southey and James Hogg and all those folks come in contact with, especially the French philosophers who were taking their positions from Thomas Tryon and some of the people in the English Revolution, so that you see intellectual traditions crossing the sea and crossing political time. And that people in one place, you know, recognize one kind of mind existing in one place and speaking to them in the time that they're in. And, yeah, that's a really interesting part of the book. And also, this is also about the time that directly after this is the time where we begin to find what I talked about last week, which is that vegetarianism traditionally was always associated with chastity, it was seen as a diet that reduced animal instincts in general, and those animal instincts being the instinct to kill, the instinct to harm. And for people of, you know, it seems many, many, many generations, the instinct for sexual desire.
Well, there's still an element of this which survives in the vegetarian zealot milieu.
Well, see, this is what I was going to say. This is like I talked about it last week, that in general, I think one of the great unheralded triumphs of the 60s is that it isn't really that much in
Not where sex is concerned.
But
where violence is concerned, it is.
Where violence is, but where to have it removed from sex is a big deal.
I think it's
actually a big advancement. And as I said, I think it's one of the hidden advancements of the 60s, is that nobody ever tries to get you to be a vegetarian on the basis of, you know, having it reduce your sex drive anymore.
That wouldn't really work very well these days.
It wouldn't really work very well these days. And you could say, you know, that, yes, that's why. And perhaps.
But the notion that meat makes you warlike is still very much alive.
Right. Yeah. But the whole, I think it's a big, big thing that the whole idea that vegetarianism does not make you less sexually driven is a huge deal, and I think it has a lot to do with why there are more vegetarians now than there have been in earlier time periods. And what I have not learned from reading this book, what I have not learned, I might add, from living my life or from reading any other book on the history of vegetarianism is exactly why this would be the case. I mean, what you just said is, you know, a kind of a cynical reason for it, which is like you're not going to get many people to be vegetarian if you tell them that it reduces their sex drive. But even beyond that, I'm not really quite sure that that's the reason why this moved out of vegetarian propaganda.
No, I'm not saying it's the only reason.
And it certainly is a quite interesting development because, as I said, I'm sure there are many, many, many more vegetarians that have. I'm sure the vegetarian practicing group is much, much larger that has developed in the last 40 years than was practicing in the 60 years before that.
Oh yeah,
wouldn't
really?
You say?
Oh,
I would
sure.
think.
In America,
I,
absolutely.
Or I think, yeah, in America and in Western Europe.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is what this book that we're discussing, right. The Bloodless Revolution by Tristram Stewart, is discussing. I believe that is, yeah, I'm sure it's like much, much larger, you know, than it has been in the past 100 years. That vegetarianism as a practice just keeps growing and growing and growing. I think it becomes a bigger deal as years go by. And it's interesting because one of the biggest arguments for it in previous years is one that is no longer used at all, mm-hmm. and that is the chastity argument. That is no longer used. But as you pointed out very usefully, that the idea that somehow it makes you less violent, that is used all the time.
Yes.
The idea that, and that kind of argument that if people just sort of inure themselves to the shedding of blood for eating, then they're going to inure themselves to the shedding of blood for many other purposes. And so that people will become more merciful in general and more empathetic and more sympathetic if they do not depend upon the, you know, eating animals for food. That's a really ancient argument that goes back, in fact, to Pythagoras. That's one of the reasons
right.
that Shelley and Byron and, you know, all these other, you know, folks took it up in the first place, was they believed that particular part of the argument. But part of the argument really was this other thing, that there was something that there's something about animal drives that was involved with eating meat, and that if you didn't eat the meat, that you would, like, cut back on the animal drives. But we now believe that there are some animal drives that we want.
Which
and
we
some
embrace.
Animal drives that, yes, which we embrace and want to just. Yes,
or try to, at least.
We want to expand. And other animal drives that we don't. And in a weird way, you would think that this would make the argument for vegetarianism weaker. But it hasn't. It's had exactly the opposite effect. It made it much, much stronger. It's been much more successful.
So do you know that there's going to be the first Veggie Pride Parade on May 18th?
No, I had no idea.
Yes.
But I'm very pleased to find it out. And where is it going to be?
They're going to be meeting in the Meat District.
That's it. Well, that's a great place to have it.
Or as they call it, the former Meat District, which it really is at this point. Gansevoort Square, 12 a.m.
Well, yeah.
12 noon.
Sadly enough, it really is the former
yes.
Meat District. Yes,
yeah.
It's sort of, yeah.
So, are you going to go?
Well,
you're
what,
not. You're a lapsed vegetarian,
what,
right?
Well, it doesn't mean I couldn't go.
That's
well,
true.
What day of the week is it? I don't eat vegetables? Of course I do.
I can check my calendar and tell you what day of the week it is, but I don't know offhand. It doesn't say on their website. Can you imagine that?
What is it? What's the day again?
May 18th.
May 18th? Oh, no, I don't know. Mm. If it were April, I probably could tell you.
Yes.
But,
anyway, so can I respond to some of the things you've said about vegetarianism?
Please.
Yeah.
Please.
Well, just as long as we brought it up, and one is you're less of a vegetarian than I am at this point.
I would say much less, aren't you? I mean, since you are indeed a vegetarian and I'm not, so
okay.
I would think.
All right, but I mean, a pure vegetarian, a vegan, would say that I'm really not. because
okay.
And I do I do eat things that come out of the sea. I do eat fish, and it's kind of a guilty.
What do they call it? A pescatarian?
I'm an ovo-lacto-pisco vegetarian, to be entirely precise.
And let's be entirely precise.
Yes, let us.
Since it is our show.
Exactly. In fact, if one wants to include shellfish, which I do, I would be an ovo-lacto-mollusco-crustaceo pisco vegetarian.
Okay.
Okay. And so, I mean, well, I haven't actually had a bite of red meat or poultry since I was 15.
Right.
That's kind of where I draw the line. And I have no desire to at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Why?
Let's say why, because we haven't been talking about why. Let's talk
okay,
about
why. Okay, why do I have no desire, or why am I...
Why do you draw the line there and not somewhere else?
Oh, all right. Well, as I was going to say, fish is actually a bit of a guilty pleasure, I will acknowledge.
Because they have faces?
Not because they have faces, no. I mean, this is... When I was 15, my original reason was more like, oh, I don't want to eat the cute little animals, right?
Right.
Those are no longer my reasons at all.
Okay.
And I think that probably even when I was 15, I, on an intuitive level, I had more legitimate reasons than I did on a rational level.
Okay.
So, no, it's not because they have faces, but it's because, I mean, you're aware of what's going on with the salmon on the West Coast right now, right?
Oh, the whole overfishing thing
is
incredible. We should do a show on overfishing.
Yes.
I should say another show. I know we've done a number of shows, but we should
disastrous.
Probably, yeah. It's shocking.
It really is.
Even if you think you know enough about it, it's shocking.
Yes.
Yeah.
And just another symptom of the whole sort of, global protein shock, which we seem to be going through. I mean, there's food riots. I started off the show by mentioning there's food riots going on all over the world now. You know?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
I mean, Haiti, Bangladesh, El Salvador, all over the place, there's food riots going on. And meanwhile, the salmon have just, they've not returned. This is like the first year that they've just like not returned. So,
right.
And it's staggered. That doesn't mean that, they aren't going to return next year. Maybe they'll return next year.
But given the way things are in
it's a bad sign.
Right.
It's a bad sign.
In the rivers and the oceans and all the places where they're supposed to be making their way from.
Exactly.
No, things don't look good.
No, things don't look good. Right. Despite the fact that, they breed up in the mountains, and then they go out to sea, and then they return.
They have a long way to go before they return up there.
Right, exactly. So it's staggered. So it's not like, just because they don't return one year, that means that there's not going to be any the next year. So maybe they'll recover. We certainly hope so. But it's very, very ominous. But they just haven't come back to either the, Sacramento or Columbia River or Klamath River at all this year.
Yeah.
So, just in very, very small numbers. Quite terrifying. So, I don't feel so guilty when I eat a tilapia, because a tilapia is a fish which can be, which can live its whole life very happily in a bathtub, and it's a fish which can be sustainably farmed, whereas salmon really is not, when I eat salmon, which is rare, but I do eat it sometimes, it's kind of a guilty pleasure. It really is, because it's not sustainable. I mean, eating tilapia is more or less sustainable. But
what about farmed salmon that has the food coloring put into it?
Right, exactly. See, that's not real food. A salmon cannot, for instance, it starts to lose its coloring. And you have to put in all of these extra additives into their food and whatnot if it's farmed salmon.
What if it was farmed salmon and they didn't attempt to color it? Would you feel that was all right? Had that really weird gray,
because
white?
A salmon really needs to, to migrate from the mountains up out to the ocean and back.
And eat the little shrimpy things.
What's that?
And eat the little shrimpy things.
Yes, exactly. Right. And whereas, a tilapia doesn't. So, fish is a guilty pleasure. And it varies from fish to fish. Some fish are more sustainable than others. But it is a guilty pleasure. And there's some fish which I sort of do try to stay away from, like swordfish,
Yeah, swordfish. Swordfish seems to be pretty. Yeah, swordfish has been like threatened for a long time and seems never to have quite come back from the threat.
Yeah.
I mean, for 10 or 12 years.
Right. And also because it's such a heavily carnivorous fish itself, it accumulates lots of toxins
problems
up the food chain, and its flesh is the consistency of meat. It really would
be a good idea for us to come up with something on overfishing, because the last few things I've read on overfishing and from the Greenpeace reports are that it's even worse than we think. because the fishing limits that they keep putting forward from what they call the IFC and everything is that no one who's in a country where they haven't had some like disastrous like downfall like believes that there's actually a problem. So when they're presented with really like small like fishing hauls, they just think that it's like BS. And the result is that it's all going to crash even sooner.
Exactly. Which is just a part of the global protein crash, which
but the whole thing with the sea is like when I was a kid and when you were a kid, they were always talking about farming the oceans and how, you know, we could like, you know, and many, many people listening to this are old enough to remember this whole thing that like you could always fall back on the ocean. When everything else fell apart, well, the ocean was going to be there and we're going to farm this and that, the other thing. And every time they have something where they throw old subway trains in the ocean and grow oysters on them or something, I think leads people to believe the same thing, that somehow we're going to be able to overcome some of the land problems by, like, fishing the seas. Right. We're going to have – and the opposite is the case, yes. You know, that, like, we've blown out the seas in this amazingly short period of time. It's really – it's shocking and – sad and depressing and anything.
Right,
you
it makes me
use.
Think. I mean, every time I eat salmon, I think, okay, I could be like, you know, the last generation on Earth.
Who's going to eat one?
Who's going to enjoy salmon?
Right, you know? Who's going to eat an actual salmon and knows what it tastes like? Right.
Okay, but why do I now maintain my vegetarianism? Apart from the fact that my body is adjusted to it over, my God, how many years have been between, how many years from 15 to 45? I can't do the math. However many years that is.
30
years, okay. My body is adjusted
you
to
really
it.
You really couldn't do 30 from that?
Yeah, what? Not while I'm trying to think on my feet.
Okay, fine. I was going to say, because I'm really bad at math.
Is it 30? So a part of the problem is I'm loath to acknowledge that I'm really that old, so I've got a mental block
on that particular
math.
Sorry. Right.
But after 30 years, my digestive system and so on has adjusted to not eating red meat, and I find it disgusting. So that's one reason. And I find chicken.
You find it disgusting, or your body can't digest it.
Both, you know, I find it disgusting because my body can't digest it. Because
after not eating red meat for a long time, when I went to college, I had been a vegetarian, and also in my house we weren't eating red meat for years and years, and then. You could either for your like grand Saturday meal, you could either have like an avocado with something on it, or you could have a steak.
Where was this?
This was at UC Santa Cruz.
Oh yeah.
And
at
so
some
I said, well, I'm going to have
where you were living?
No. Well, I was living at school, and I said, well, I'm going to have a steak.
Mm.
And the whole, I gave it up because did it several weeks in a row, and after not eating red meat for all those years, every time I ate the steak, it was delicious.
Oh really?
But I couldn't digest it. Mm, it just like came right out of me. I could not. I mean, I'm sure I didn't even get any, you know, nutrition out of it because it just came out of me.
All right. Well, okay. So I
suppose
it's possible.
So I believe that something like, I think that that is very common.
You can actually
find
it aesthetically pleasing and still not be able to digest it. Whatever.
Yeah.
I don't find it aesthetically pleasing. But that's not the main reason that I maintain vegetarianism. It's mostly for political reasons today. Because, you know, just like biofuels or agrofuels and tree farms and so on, the cattle industry is ironically contributing to the protein crash.
Absolutely. And you are listening to this discussion on WBAI FM New York, part of the Pacifica Network, 99.5 listener sponsored radio. And this is the Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade. My name is Anne Marie Hendrickson, and I am speaking with
Bill Weinberg about why I'm a vegetarian. If I can toot my own horn here now, you know, I've written two books about the role of the cattle industry in Mexico and Central America. And, you know, it's utterly sinister, not only in terms of the human rights implications of peasants getting kicked off of lands by paramilitary goons and, you know, all the, hideous violence associated with that. But also, I mean, the fact that, you know, the peasants are trying to grow rice and beans and, you know, or corn and beans to feed themselves and in a very efficient manner. And the people who are kicking them off of the land and disappropriating them are, in very inefficient manner, producing much less protein per acre to grow beef for export.
Right.
So, I mean, this is the big reason I'm a vegetarian today. You know, political reasons. I think, you know, the beef industry is extremely ecologically destructive and politically reactionary.
But you could eat meat and not eat beef. You could eat something other than beef. I mean, you could be a non-beef, non-vegetarian. I mean, being a non-vegetarian doesn't necessarily mean eating beef.
This is true, you know, and I don't, by no means do I...
I'm playing devil's advocate.
No,
I'm not saying that
well
you should not be. I'm just saying,
don't
want to eat beef, and that's your main reason is because of this beef thing in Mexico and in other countries. I mean, what if you ate something other than beef and other than salmon? Would that change it for you? If you were to eat, say, what would it be? What if you were to eat wild hunted animals, for example?
Okay, well, that's just what I was going to say, you know, is that I don't view it as a moral absolute, and I certainly don't begrudge the Lakota the right to, raise bison and to eat the bison that they raise. But that's not how I choose to live my life, and I couldn't afford to buy free-range bison here in New York City, even if I chose to live that way. And I kind of resent
that. Really? How much is it?
I would imagine it's pretty expensive, and I would imagine the only places where you can get it is at places like Whole Foods, which are... You know, just sort of this yuppie plague, which is displacing, mom and pop grocery shops. So living my life the way I live it, it kind of makes sense for me to be a vegetarian. That doesn't mean that I view it as a moral absolute. And I think that, you know, anybody who eats meat under any circumstances is bad. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. But if it makes ethical and political sense in my life and the circumstances that I live to be a vegetarian.
My question is, I don't think that Whole Foods is displacing mom-and-pop grocery stores. I think it's displacing food co-ops.
Well, that too. Both.
I think, well, no. Mom-and-pop grocery stores don't stock the things that food co-ops did. It's why food co-ops existed, you know, because they had, farmer-to-consumer relationships even before probably, like, the green markets were, like, working harder on developing things like that. And I think a lot of people that don't want to deal with stuff like that are more likely to go to Whole Foods. Because the Whole Food, if you go into Whole Food, in fact, I could make an excellent case for it, because the first thing you see is their produce section. It's the thing when you go down the escalator or up the escalator, whatever it is, and depending on what location you go into, that's the first thing you see is all these beautiful fruits and vegetables, the things that you would see if you went to the green market.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they get people. That's the people that they attract to doing the bulk of the shopping there are people that otherwise I think might have been more likely to go to something like the green market.
Yes, that's certainly true. But I mean, just in my own neighborhood, for instance, a Whole Foods just opened up, and the Met Food, okay, it's a big, you know, chain franchise thing, but still it's owned by just this local guy, and it's where all the working class people in my neighborhood go to shop.
Right, of course.
Is now threatened because I believe it's NYU owns the property and is threatening the guy with eviction.
But
so,
that's because NYU is threatening. That's the NYU problem. I don't even see. I think that's a little separate from that.
It is. It and it isn't. I'm not suggesting that it's a direct cause and effect relationship.
Because you seriously think that all those blue collar people are going to go shopping in Whole Foods?
No, that's just it. No. Of course not. That's the whole point. It's indicative of the whole general cultural and economic change which is taking place in New York City. Anyway, so let me turn the question around.
Okay.
Why are you no longer a vegetarian? Why did you choose to become an omnivore?
Because I felt that I was, my main reason for being a vegetarian was the ecological reason, was that it just didn't make sense to be basing your diet around meat when it was a very expensive, in fact, wasteful way of, you know, contributing protein to the diet and everything else. And that you could easily, you know, support yourself and, in fact, make delicious meals by, you know, just eliminating that, and that you would, you know, you could live well on that. And I lived like that for, you know, off and on, like, as I said, for decades. And the two things that began to get me was, I'm not really sure, especially when you get into a lot of the processed and foods for vegetarians, I'm not sure that you're really, like, I'm pretty sure that you're not really getting around that particular kind of quandary. And the second thing was, I really, like, it really began to get me that there were all kinds of food cultures, and because it was a food culture, not just the food, but because food is really central to anybody's culture, there are all kinds of cultures that I was not really exploring here in New York, which has so many people from so many different places, because I was refusing to eat their food in the way that they normally would prepare it. And that just began to get to me more and more. And at some point, I just stopped. I mean, I still eat, you know, a vegetarian meal still seems like a meal to me. You know, I don't feel like, oh, unless there's like a little piece of meat on it, I'm not eating a meal or anything. And so I don't eat meat all the time, but I no longer feel like it's no longer a principle to me that I can't eat meat. And I no longer have this feeling that, because of, I said, of all the stuff I know around the way that, a lot of it maybe had to do with sort of like my disillusion around the whole thing around soybeans. I think that might have been a lot of it. You know, the whole, you know, the soybeans are so largely genetically engineered and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah. And then soy is also displacing.
And since I was a vegetarian of the 70s when soy was pushed so heavily, I mean, I think that was probably, but that might have been the first push for me, even before the other stuff I just said. Right. It was just the whole thing around that soy was sort of a bust and, you know.
Well, in particular, I mean, in Paraguay and Brazil now, this soy is just massively expanding and pushing peasants off of their lands and these big agribusiness soy plantations.
And in the United States.
Yeah.
In the United States, it is.
Well, we don't have peasants here.
But we have farmers. Yes. And God, in the United States, has been pushing people off the land for, you know, the last two decades. You know, and soy is a...
And a lot of it goes to
and
cattle
And as a woman,
feed.
I mean...
A lot of the soy goes to cattle feed, by the way.
Right. Yeah. As a woman, it was often pushed to women as some sort of like master fuel for women. You know, that it was like had all this kind of like funky hormonal stuff that helped PMS, it helped menopause, it helped like you in the childbearing years. That soy was the answer, and it seems quite clear, you know, in retrospect, that all this was sort of like a bust. And as I was saying last week, I mean, one of the things that I have learned, if I have learned anything, is that the whole idea that there's some kind of wonder food, that's always a mistake.
Yeah, but I never believed that there was any kind of wonder food. I was never a soy cultist.
I didn't believe the soy stuff either. I mean, but like I said, it was just part of the
whole
thing.
I mean, I eat tofu once in a while, but I'm not a soy cultist, and I never eat, you know, tofu pups or soy pseudo meat or any stuff like that. You know, that's not
right.
That's not real
food.
And
I'm sure you probably also have, you know, read as much as I have that over the last 10 years that the better way to eat soy is in fermented form, that you should, if you're going to eat it, probably miso and tempeh and stuff are better ways to eat it. But, in fact, I was just at a dinner party just a few nights ago where we were talking about just this subject, but I think it's more maybe that just the whole expansion of the whole organic industry in the last 25 years that has changed my feelings around the idea that it's really better for the earth to be a vegetarian, because I'm not really sure that that's the case anymore, you know, given the expansion of things like Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and all this other stuff. I mean, it just seems that all these, that, you know, you can McDonald'size all vegetarian things as you know, as well as you could anything
absolutely.
Else.
Absolutely. Vegetarianism
in and of itself
definitely be co-opted into something.
And then it already has been.
And has been, indeed.
And that,
yes.
that in and of itself is kind of
right.
meaningless.
I never viewed vegetarianism as a panacea either, you know.
Right. Well, I never did either. So, I mean, which in a way is why it's, I guess, a little, but because I didn't, it's why it's not like I can't stick to it as like I have to do this anymore because I can't see it anymore as something like if I stop doing this, something really bad is going to happen, which is what I would have to do in order to make it I have to do this. I could just sort of say, which is what I do, on the whole, I'm going to move more in this direction than the other, but it's no longer like just a fact that I will not eat meat.
So is it going to, your basic leanings are still vegetarian?
My leanings are still there, you know, leanings are one thing in practice, you know. You can't just say, oh, well, basically I don't, but sometimes I do, then you're not. Mm. You know, you're not a vegetarian if you're just leaning in that direction, but you don't do it. Mm.
But what I don't kind of get is why you feel that like you were missing aspects of what the ethnic cuisines that New York has to offer because you don't eat meat. Because I mean, I don't eat meat, and I don't feel that way at all. And as you know, I'm an avid enthusiast for the various ethnic cuisines of the city.
I don't understand why you don't feel that way. How can you not feel that way? You can't eat calf face or anything of this stuff. I mean, you can't.
What's that?
It's cow face. You can't go sit down and eat like a cow head and eat the eyes and all this stuff. I mean,
but I have no desire to. But the
but then you're not eating. You're not eating like a basic Greek thing. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of basic things you're not eating.
Yes, but feta cheese is also a basic Greek thing.
Olives are also basic Greek things.
I can. There isn't a Greek restaurant in New York City where I couldn't find something to eat and enjoy.
I'm sure that's true. I'm just saying there's a big part of the menu that you wouldn't even look at because
you would have
excluded before you walked in, and as I did for many years. Mm. And that's what I'm saying. And part of a lot of it, as I've said, is because I moved to Astoria. And Astoria is such a food trip that was kind of what did it for me because it's not just, you know, it's Greek and Thai and, you know, Serbian, Croatian and, you know, I mean, Czech and Polish and Russian and Ukrainian, you know, every place you go, you know, it's just one thing after another. And yes, you could just say, well, I'll just have the olives, but, you know, and I don't know, maybe I would have been a better person if that was the decision that I made.
No,
but
I'm not being judgmental, but
it was so cool to encounter.
But it isn't like I would just eat the olives. I mean, first of all, you can get a good piece of fish at any. And I do eat fish.
See,
at
you do have fish.
Well,
you just
there
do
you
put
go.
Fish in it. Okay, yeah. Fine.
Well, that's, you know, that we're talking about you and me and our dietary habits. And those are my dietary habits.
Well, okay, if I let fish in it, then yes, okay, then I could probably, yes, absolutely. Especially I could let a lot of the Greek things in because the fish is the best thing usually in the Greek restaurant.
There you go.
Fish and the lamb, so. But I could leave out the lamb, and I'd still have all that great fish. That's true.
Anyway, I don't feel like I'm missing a thing. And as you know, I mean, I love to.
Well, when I was a vegetarian, I didn't feel like I was missing a thing either. Mm-hmm. I mean,
But apparently you did at some point.
Well, I liked meat. I didn't. Some people become vegetarians because they don't like meat. They just don't like the taste of it, and it kind of grosses them out.
Well, I guess I fall into that category.
And I was not one of those people. I mean, I kind of missed it when I didn't eat it. But on the other hand, I like food enough that given a good meal, I didn't say, gee, if only I had a little burger with this or something. You know, I just thought that was a great meal, you know, and I always felt like that. So, I don't really have a good answer. I don't have a good answer as to why I became a vegetarian, and I don't have a good answer as to why I stopped being one. I could give you an answer in both directions, but I don't really have a good answer. You know, there were many reasons to not be one in the first place, and there were many reasons to continue to be one.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say, you know, this isn't one of those Saul at Tarsus kind of moments in either direction where I could say, I couldn't do anything else. I just had to do that. It wasn't like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this does sort of play into my other perhaps contention with some of what you said over the past two shows, where particularly in the one you did, was it 3 weeks ago, where you were sort of posing, on one hand, you've got vegetarians who are all these sort of very fussy, hand-wringing Puritans who are very, very concerned about, you know, not defiling the temple of the body with impurities. And on the other hand, you've got these real enthusiastic foodies who are, you know, really Epicurean.
Eating bats and eating grubs.
Well, yeah, eating foie gras, I suppose.
And eating foie gras, exactly, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I sort of see myself as a vegetarian hedonist. I mean,
vegetarian epicure, you might say.
Yes.
Oh, exactly. See, my kind of vegetarian. That's what I was just saying. I became a vegetarian because I read this book called The Vegetarian Epicure.
Her whole thing was
she wasn't, you know, and I still love this book. And, you know, was that her whole point was like, you don't become a vegetarian because you're trying to, you know, restrict yourself or because you feel guilty. It's because there's just this whole world of food, and because you're so focused on the burger, you don't even see all the other foods that are available to you.
Who wrote that again?
Anna Thomas, The Vegetarian Epicure, and she had several different volumes, but that was exactly how I felt. It was a great way of looking at it.
In the 70s?
In the 70s, and it was it was brilliant. And that's exactly right. You know, the people are so thinking like, well, I have like bread or potato, and I have this vegetable, and I have this little piece of meat. And she said, no, your meal can be so much more than that if you just, like, think bigger than that. And, you know, you have to, but it's not an anti-food thing. It's a pro-food
right.
thing.
Well, I mean, I never saw that book, but that's totally my attitude.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was a great book. It was and is a great book. And it's, and the people that, and I should say that, I mean, I met many vegetarians over the years, as you have, you know, who have, like, some kind of weird, hostile relation to food. But most of the vegetarians I've known are kind of the opposite, wouldn't you say? I mean, they're, like, they're foodies in a big way. So, and, I mean, one of the things that Michael Pollan says, I think, in The Omnivore's Dilemma, kind of in passing, is he just said, well, one of the things you can by vegetarians is they're really interested in food, and they're interested in where food comes from and, you know, how it gets here, and they're interested in how it gets on their plate. And, yeah, that's true. All those things are really true. I've never met anybody who was a vegetarian of whom all those things weren't true. And
Pollan is not a vegetarian.
Well, no, as the title of his book would tend to suggest.
Right. The Omnivore's Dilemma. Right. Mm-hmm.
My problem with that book and with his follow-up book, or that would almost take a whole, it would take another show. I don't, have you read his book?
I've got so many friends who are such avid enthusiasts of Michael Pollan, and every time
there's a lot to be said for him.
Yeah, there really is.
I mean, and I am enthusiastic, but in a way, and I certainly think it's gotten people talking about food
in a way. No, I'm not dismissing him at all. I'm just saying that.
Otherwise, it seems like a lot of books written by people who write for things like Harper's or The New Yorker he assumes a middle-class audience that you and I would not assume. And it's kind of hard to relate to a lot of what he says because of it.
Well,
like in defense of food, he says, you know, people have to get used to paying more for food, and that the idea that like you pay less for food is like a modern invention of the last 70 years. And I would say this is one of the positive steps of the last 70 years, you know, and the idea that people can afford to pay more for food, maybe some people, but a lot of people can barely afford to pay for any food.
So have you read Nina Plank's book?
What's it called?
Real Food, How to Eat and Why.
Most interesting thing I found about, I love the whole discussion of milk and cheese. I mean, you read it, right?
No, but again, I've got so many friends who are crazy about her, and every time I turn around, she's being interviewed on WNYC, so I kind of know what her shtick is. But what does she say about milk?
Well, just that milk was seasonal until recently, for example. I mean, that we don't really know. I mean, one thing I know, because we always get organic milk at home, but we don't get, like, farmer's market organic milk. We get, like, Organic Valley or Horizon organic milk.
Where do you get it?
You know, the supermarket. Yeah. You can get it anywhere. But it's uber pasteurized. And as she points out, that's like barely like milk if you're going to get it like that. We just get it because I think that like standard non-organic milk has so much stuff in it that you don't want to drink it. But it's not the same as.
All right. So what, it changes by being pasteurized?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's a big part of the argument of her book, that pasteurization changes for the worse a lot of things about milk, and that pasteurization caught on as as a technology because of urbanization. You know, that the point is that if you pasteurize milk, you can keep it in stores for a while. But and before they started doing it, that when people had unpasteurized milk, you know, kids got sick from it all the time because, you know, raw milk you can only have for a brief period.
Yes.
Now, when I was growing up, they actually raw milk is legal to sell in California.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. The Altadena Dairy was just a couple of towns over from me, and you know you could actually sell it. It was not just delivered at doors, but you could buy it in grocery stores, which you can't do here. I think you can buy raw milk in New York State in. I think you can buy it from the farmer, but you can't buy it in stores.
Hmm.
And
has that changed in California too?
I don't think so. I think they still have it. Hmm. But yeah, I mean the taste of the milk is very different. And I mean, well, you should look at it. It's just an interesting argument. I mean, one of the points she makes is that a lot of people who think that they're lactose intolerant are really just intolerant of pasteurized milk. For example, that yogurt and buttermilk and things like that come from milk souring, but pasteurized milk never sours. It just goes bad. And that the lactose that people are allergic to turns into lactic acid. That's what turns milk into yogurt or buttermilk.
Mm-hmm.
And that never happens with pasteurized milk because, you know, the milk has been heated so far that it's not there anymore.
Uh-huh. So, in other words, lactose intolerance is a complete misnomer, she's arguing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it may exist, but that it wouldn't come up for most.
But it's not what people think it is.
It's not what people think it is.
Right.
I mean, they would in fact have an allergy to fresh milk, but that they wouldn't have an allergy to fermented milk, and that's why you find throughout the South, where you have a lot of people from Africa, that you have a lot of things made from buttermilk. The buttermilk is a standard, like, kind of southern kind of form of milk, and that she feels that that's one of the reasons why it was so common there. And that a lot of, like, in the Mediterranean and in East Africa, that they use a lot of yogurt and kefir and things like that, and that's all, again, places where, you know, people historically have have a problem with lactose,
right,
but they don't have a problem, you know. It's not that they don't have a problem with milk.
Right.
With fermented milk.
Yeah.
They can handle fermented milk without a problem, but they just can't. They can't do it with fresh milk, with sweet milk.
All right. So we've just got 3 minutes left. So, we both heartily recommend The Bloodless Revolution by Tristram Stewart, A Cultural History of Vegetarianism from 1600 to Modern Times.
The more you know about vegetarianism, the more you're going to learn from the book. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't care about it, then whatever. But if you know a lot about it already, you're going to find out stuff that you never even knew you didn't know. It's an amazing book. It's one of the most amazing books I've read in the past 5, 6, 7 years. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. I've been recommending it to people all over the place.
And all of you vegetarian zealots out there who feel that you are not sufficiently honored by American society will want to go out and march in the first Veggie Pride Parade in America, which will take place in the West Village on May 18th, meeting at noon in the Meat District, of course.
The former Meat District.
The former Meat District, exactly. Which even vegetarians amongst us might wish was still, in fact, the Meat District. So
maybe the Milk District.
So what do you think about vegetarianism, to sum up? As a somebody who's obviously still avidly interested in the subject, but is yourself no longer a practicing vegetarian?
You learn so much about food from being one, everybody should do it.
Right. I'll second that without a doubt.
I might not go back to being it again. I mean, to me, it just completely revolutionized the way I thought about food. And, you know, that's great. Everybody should think more about what they eat, not less.
So no regrets over your vegetarian years?
Oh, not at all. Mm-hmm. No, of course not.
And no regrets over your current omnivorous state?
No.
Very good. Okay. Well, do you know D.D. Sharp?
Oh, yes. Is this the same? Were we thinking of the same person? I believe so.
The woman who recorded Gravy for My Mashed
Potatoes. Yes.
Shall we go out with that?
Oh, absolutely.
So, this has been the Morris Orthodox Radio Crusade on listener-supported non-commercial WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City with Bill Weinberg and Anne-Marie Hendrickson, back by popular demand. Do stay tuned for Weaponry with Tom Whisker coming up next. We've got a special musical show happening next week, so join us then. And until such time, a big salam aleikum. Whoops. No. Oh, stop it. Stop it. Stop it.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.